I'm Charlene. In these 20-minute podcasts, I talk with memoir writers about their books, their lives, and their writing process. Sharing like this helps us all connect. As we listen, we learn about the world through the eyes of others. Their stories help us expand our views and empathize more deeply with each other. It's my pleasure now to invite you to listen in to this episode of Life Story on Soul Sciences. Hello, listeners. I'm here today with Joanne Silver Jones, and you are going to be deeply drawn in, as I was, to Joanne's story. Thank you, Joanne, for your time and coming onto the program.
You're very welcome.
Joanne, would you please tell our listeners what made you or turned you toward writing a memoir called Headstrong, Surviving a Traumatic Brain Injury?
Yes, I know I've been asked the question. I think about it a lot. And my answer has become that the story drew itself to me. It begins with a terrible assault that I experienced 10 years ago, just before the inauguration of President Obama, and I was beaten by a stranger, a complete random act of violence, and he beat me with a hammer. My skull was cracked and my hands were broken, and needless to say, my life, which I'm grateful for, changed in an instant. I thought I was going to die, but fortunately that didn't happen. And it was some years before I really was able to do anything. And then I started to make a few notes, and I was a college professor at the time. And so writing and making notes was something I did. And then about 4 years after the assault, I would say the book kind of knocked at my consciousness and said, let's really start writing. And I went away for a weekend and words poured out. And I didn't intend to write a memoir or intend to write a book, but it found me and it came out of me.
And did you find that cathartic in any way? And how would you describe the writing process involved with how your healing was taking place?
Sure. I wouldn't say that it was cathartic in terms of the seriousness of my trauma and my PTSD and the physical injuries. I had amazing and still have amazing therapists and doctors who helped me through all of that. What was so important and remarkable was how writing tapped into a whole different part of me, into a whole vein of creativity that I really hadn't been in before. And one of the side effects, permanent side effects of traumatic brain injury is really the inability to focus, cognitive fatigue. And for many years, I wasn't really able to read. When I started writing, I could be in it and I could focus. And I was there. I wasn't in any other world. I was in my book. And it was exhilarating to actually almost be out of myself to get into this story. And that has had a profound impact on me. I actually think it helped with the, what do they call it, neuroplasticity, to helping me rewire some parts of my brain and to give me a sense of satisfaction and purpose and joy that I hadn't had in any other place since the assault. And I still love it.
Oh, you're still writing.
Yeah, I'm still writing. And of course, I'm doing a lot to promote the book and writing things for it. And it's such a wonderful feeling when I sit down and I have my fingers on the, you know, the keyboard, and I feel like maybe what a good musician or anybody who's doing something that they love to do, regardless of whether they're recognized or paid or anybody even knows they're doing it. So that has been what's been so profound for me.
Isn't that powerful? I have a friend named Deb Brandon who wrote a book.
You know Deb? Yes, of course.
I just love Deb. I've had her on the program, and please express, because you were so quick about knowing her.
Yes.
Talk to us about Deb as well.
We're published by the same press, and actually we don't live far from each other. She's in Boston. And after I published my book, I sent it to her and asked if she'd read it and if she liked it, if she'd comment. And she wrote a beautiful piece for the book. So we've connected through having brain injuries and the publisher and both being academics who have moved to writing.
Yes, and just briefly for our listeners, Deb is a math professor or a professor in the math department at Carnegie Mellon, who woke up to find out very suddenly that she had something called cavernous angioma and had to have three brain surgeries, and very much the slowing down of her life. And she found also that writing was released in her. And she has said to me on the program that she wouldn't take back her old life, even if she could, because it didn't have writing in it. Do you feel similarly, or how does that feel for you?
Not at all. I think I don't, because what happened to me was violent and is still so traumatic for my family. One of the, it's not really a blessing, but I only remember, maybe a tiny bit of a second. And I don't remember anything after that for some time. It was, in a way, I wasn't there, but my family was. And I wouldn't put that on them. And being the victim of random violence also rearranges one's life. And the interior of, my brain and my body forever. And I would not want to, for me or anybody, to experience such violence.
No, exactly. I can hear the difference. I can see the difference, too, of something like that violence, which is, and as you may know, I've been through extraordinary violence myself, but it when it's imposed from the outside, I think it's different than if it's a disease or something that you can't control from the inside of your body. It's not quite so easy to see it as, just kind of an act of nature.
But, right.
You mentioned your family. Would you mind discussing a little bit about how this affected them? In your book, you write about the tremendous support that you received from everyone.
Yeah, I'm so fortunate. I have an incredible safety net under me that has no holes in it anywhere. So the assault happened a number of yards behind my daughter's house. She wasn't home at the moment. I was going to meet her for dinner. And I actually, at the moment that of the assault, I was thinking about what I'd order for dinner. I was going to order lamb shanks, slowly cooked in red wine. That is so clear in my mind. And so she got all these phone calls saying, your mother wants to see you. She's in the hospital. And she had no idea what it was. And of course, she saw me. I don't know what she saw. She saw, my head bloody and me in terrible pain and blood behind her house. And that's, she still is very, very protective of me, doesn't want me to go anyplace alone. And so it's certainly for me, it's also, it was so distressing for her, the thought that, I am in such jeopardy. And my wife was at a birthday party in Massachusetts and received a phone call from an officer who said, how did she know me? My wife said we were married. And then the officer said, sit down. Nothing good comes when a police officer says sit down. And my wife had also been through the death of her mother and, major losses. So she made her way to Washington to find me, about to undergo brain surgery, and then really has spent large parts of the last 10 years taking care of me and worrying about me, and I needed a lot of care. My grandson was only 8 at the time, and then he didn't know what had happened, really, but he would just come and sit by my side and pretend to play with a little computer. He brought me to class for show and tell because I had a service dog. and he wanted people to see the service dog. And he too is so frightened if I go someplace, if I'm by myself. So they're all, and other members of my family, are hyper-focused. And I have heard people say that it's almost harder if you're not the victim, but you see somebody else and you can't help and you can't stop it. And so they still, I mean, not that I don't live with a lot, and so do they. And that's what happens with all random violence that is far too frequent in the south of the 49th parallel. That everybody connected in every sort of ring of closeness is traumatized. And eventually we all are, because it can happen anywhere, anytime to anyone. Which to me says, go on with your life. Live it.
It reminds me of a passage in the book, The World According to Garp, by John Irving. And an airplane crashes into a house. And he decides that that's the reason he should buy the house, because the chance of another airplane crashing into it.
Exactly.
And one almost has to take that view, I think. You know, I think we stumbled out of the Second World War with a very intense desire collectively to create the safest culture that could be created.
Yeah.
And God love us all. But the nature of life, it seems to me, has an edge of violence to it. And one just has to say, well, I'll be clever and cautious and I'll use my head not to get myself in a bad situation. But some things just happen and you don't know. And that's what you do with it. Do you have group therapy with your family or friends?
No, we haven't. We've talked a lot. Different members of my family have different levels of comfort with talking. My wife and I have seen a couples therapist, and we've dealt a lot with this. But we haven't dealt with this as a family in a therapeutic way.
Thinking sometimes that's better, you know, as somebody who works with people, sometimes there's too much disclosure. What do you feel?
Yeah.
Two things that I wanted you to comment on, if you would, please. One was your first service dog. Would you discuss Rocket?
Is that right? Yes.
You write about him with such love.
Yes, I still love him. Rocket came to me actually through my daughter, who was working with dogs and had a lot of friends, including the person who was the head of the Humane Society. And the head of the Humane Society, Rocket was brought in, and he did all kinds of tests. They do tests to see if a dog is aggressive. And he just loved Rocket. He was so smart and responsive. And so he called Rachel and he said, I think you should see this dog. So Rachel did the same test and then brought Rocket home with her, and he was ideal. And so she called me and I met him, and he was ideal, except Rocket also had been traumatized. He had been found in an abandoned house in Washington and had marks on him, which probably came from something that was extremely unpleasant. And the more protective he became, then the more watchful and aggressive he became to people around me, until he bit somebody and then sort of lurched at somebody else who fell. And it was all reported to animal control. And I was told either Rocket had to leave where we lived or be euthanized. I sent him to live with my daughter. I didn't even ask her. I was just so distressed.
Sure.
And then he started to bite the dogs in her house and people who came to her house. He couldn't cope. If we could have been alone in the wilderness, he'd be perfect.
Yes. I sometimes wonder the aging process. Was he getting on? Was he a bit older?
No, he was only 8 months old when I got him.
Oh, he was very young when this happened. Perhaps there was also, though, some brain damage. What do you think? Do you think it
could be? It could be, absolutely. I don't know. I think that maybe, given that I got him right away when my own nervous system was still completely dysregulated,
yes.
I would cry if a leaf touched my head.
Of course.
I cried all the time. Everything frightened me.
Yeah.
That I'm sure he picked up on that. And so I was always afraid, and he was always watchful.
Isn't that beautiful? I do believe they serve us in so many ways. You know, they actually, as you say, I believe they actually take on the emotional
absolutely
struggle and the pain. I do.
I think I might still be in bed if it wasn't for Rocket.
Really?
Yes, I had to take him outside, and I had to walk with him. And he was so much fun, and he enjoyed everything so much that it became what I enjoyed, and I would laugh, and we would play games together. And so I owe him a tremendous amount.
That's such a moving story. Will you write about that?
Yes, I did. Yeah, and I've written a piece just about him called Rocket Man that I try to get out someplace.
Oh, yeah, I would love to read it.
Yeah.
Just for the last moment of the broadcast, I would like people to know that you're a college, university professor. We call colleges differently up here. We make the distinction, but in the U.S. it's called the same thing. So I want people to
right
know you were teaching university when this happened, and you went back to teaching.
I did.
That's
I
astonishing
did
to me.
Yeah. I loved the students, and I was very committed to going back, and I did. I did for 2 more years until my fatigue was just too much and I couldn't.
Joanne, this has been just amazing, and I'm so happy that you agreed to talk with us. Will you come back again soon?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. This was delightful.
Thank you, Joanne.
Okay.
All the good now.
Bye-bye.
That's it. That's all for today. Many thanks to Kevin MacLeod for that lovely music, Carefree. And many thanks to all of you who make these podcasts possible. Remember, take good care of each other. Bye for now.